This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, we continue our candidate interviews in the upcoming federal election, and we'll speak with the Liberal and Conservative candidates in the riding of Sydney, Victoria. We'll hear about some special events coming up for Big Brothers Big Sisters in Cape Breton, and we'll speak with Canadian country music star Brett Kissel. That's all coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. As we continue our candidate interviews this week with the Liberal and Conservative candidates in the riding of Sydney, Victoria. After 8 years as a Progressive Conservative MLA for Northside Westmount, 54-year-old former physiotherapist Eddie Orrell is throwing his hat into the ring for the federal Conservatives. He spoke with Dialogue's Bobby Nock.
You've been an MLA since 2011. What prompted you to make the move into federal politics?
Well, some of the things I've been seeing on the federal side that really are affecting the people, the lives of Cape Bretoners, made me want to look seriously at jumping up into the bigger game to see if there's more we can do to help the people of our island, especially the people of Sydney, Victoria.
What are, I guess, some examples of some of the things that you think you might be able to do on the federal scene that you weren't able to do provincially?
Well, specifics, the healthcare issue is a big issue here in Cape Breton Island, and the way we give doctors residencies here in Nova Scotia is all controlled on the federal Canadian residency matching system. So if we can change that, it's a non-cost anything. It's not a monetary thing. It's just to change how residents are certified, and how you can do your residency in the province of Nova Scotia has to go through a federal screening process, and then you could be pushed wherever. We have a bunch of foreign of our own kids that are being trained foreign that are having a difficult time getting back here to do a residency. And when they go somewhere else to do a residency, if they get there and meet somebody, or if they get there and like the area, they stay. And sometimes the incentives in some of the other areas are a lot better than the incentives we can get them here. So we're on an uneven playing field with our own sons and daughters when that happens. And the other thing is the healthcare transfer payments. We've proposed a 3% increase in federal transfer payments per year if the Conservatives go to government, which would mean more money in the healthcare budget here in the province. But we also have to look at how we're doing that. So we have sicker people. We have older people. Our population is older than the average. And we've had industrialized area with steel and coal and stuff making areas. So people are sicker. So we have to look at how we transfer those payments as well, so that younger, healthier provinces that are, just because their numbers are greater, they get more money, when sicker and older provinces like ourselves and areas like Cape Breton don't get that amount of money, but they spend more money on health care because of that.
Now, the 3% a year, how does that compare to what the current Liberal government is offering in terms of transfers for health care?
Well, I haven't heard the Liberal government offering any increase in the transfer payments. So we've proposed to increase it 3% more than what is there now. So that turns out to be millions of dollars coming back into Nova Scotia towards the health care program.
On the residency front, have you spoken about this with party leader Andrew Scheer or any other officials? I mean, where does the party stand on trying to do something about this?
Well, I've spoken to the leader about it, but I've also spoken to the healthcare critic about it about a year ago, and she said that she would be up into looking into that to see what we can do to help with that and how we can help change that. Simple solution is let our med students that are being trained, that are Canadians, being trained, write their exams next to the people that are being trained in Canada, and the best person goes on the list higher than the person that wrote it. So if you have to write a test, it's a standardized test, so you get a better mark than I get, you get the first choice of where you want to go. So, and that's a simple solution. I mean, there are no more complicated things we can do with that, but the simple solution is to allow people to compete on a level playing field.
And it doesn't work that way now?
Not right now, it doesn't, no.
What else in the Conservative platform does it offer for Cape Breton and Sydney, Victoria, as far as you see it?
The carbon tax is a big thing. People in Cape Breton, we have coal that we burn here for power. We haven't developed any renewable resources here yet. So that carbon tax is hurting everybody, because anything that comes into Cape Breton comes in by truck. We don't have rail, so that puts an expense on everything you buy, from groceries to clothing to the whole shebang. So scrapping that carbon tax and replacing it with a tech type of program where you would be rewarded for improving technology to allow the carbon footprint to be decreased. The other thing is some of the grants that we've offered towards greener economy, retrofitting your home so you have a more energy efficient home, so you burn less energy, so that also takes the carbon footprint down. The new taxes that would go on recreation and arts, tax credits that will go on that, will put more money back in the pockets of the people of Cape Breton especially. And the cut in the tax rate, period, from 15 to 13.75% on the first lowest income tax rate bracket is going to help every Cape Bretoner. So things like that are going to put money back in the pockets of the people, which would mean they would spend more, which would mean we put more into the economy, which would mean we would have more money for education and healthcare and roads, because people would be paying more and spending more.
Now, experts have said that the carbon tax that the Liberal government has brought in has been proven to help reduce greenhouse or carbon emissions that contribute to global warming. And, you know, critics have said the conservative plan doesn't really address that or do that as effectively.
Well, BC has had the carbon tax caused a considerable increase in the money that people pay in British Columbia. So they've used the carbon tax for a while now, and it hasn't helped the people in the economy there. So the experts are the experts. I understand that, but you have to look at areas that are actually using it to see what they're doing and compare to what we're doing here, because we have everything in by truck. We don't have rail anymore. Shipping is down. You know, we could develop a port here in Sydney, which would be a great idea, and it's in the works. Then we could bring things in by boat, which would decrease it as well, and then develop our rail back again. So, I do understand what the experts are saying, but we got to look at where it's been in use and how it's been used.
On the whole matter of employment insurance, which we know is very important for seasonal workers here in Cape Breton, where does the Conservative Party stand on that? I know there was some tinkering under the Harper government, some changes that were made, and there were, you know, some seasonal workers at the time raised concerns about some of the changes that were made. What's the stand on
those changes, Bobby? Those changes that were made didn't really affect the people who are seasonal workers, because people didn't understand the actual changes. If you were a seasonal worker, we'll use a lobster fisherman, for example, and you went on unemployment at the end of your season, you weren't compelled to take a job that would pay you less than you would be making on unemployment. So that was a big issue, and that was a big confusion for a lot of people. I had a lot of people in my office at the MLA, and once I explained that stuff to them, they were fine to understand what the changes were. And then the other thing was that if people are out there looking for jobs, doing their job search, it didn't affect unemployment either. The basic idea of that was to get the people who just worked their 10 or 12 weeks that whatever it would take and wouldn't take another job if there was a job available. Like right now, we have a lot of jobs available and we have a lot of people who are looking for work, but there is none there for them. So some of the jobs that are in the business industry, say, or in the food service industry, they're having a hard time filling that job with people. But you're not going to take somebody who is a fisherman and put them in as a waiter, because their skills wouldn't be there. Now, there is training available for that if people want to do that. So that would be available to them if they wanted to, but they don't have to. The changes that were proposed before, you didn't have to take a job that would pay you less than you would make. And we need the seasonal workers to be able to do the farming and the fishing areas in Cape Breton, because if we don't have them, and fishermen can't get their product of the sea, or farmers can't get their product off the field, then we all lose. So if we don't have those programs in place and have it so that seasonal workers can draw the EI, then we're going to lose in the long run.
I'm sure you've been doing a bit of door-to-door already. What are you hearing from people? What's on people's minds?
Well, the big issue is healthcare. People are very concerned about the state of health care in the province, and it is a provincial issue, but there are federal components to it that we can change. The other thing is the economy. Now, people, when they elected the Trudeau government, they were promised that it would be a benefit to the middle class. But most middle-class people have seen increases in their cost of living, almost about $800 a year. So it's not doing what they said it was going to do, and it's not helping the people that they promised that they were going to help. So that is the big concern. I'm hearing a lot from seniors about their ability to either make the payments on their mortgage, make the payments on their groceries, or buy their medication, or be able to survive that way. So that has a lot to do with how people survive. Agriculture is a big issue. We don't produce enough food in Cape Breton, for example, or Nova Scotia, to feed ourselves. And they say if our supply chain was cut off, it would be 3 days, and our grocery shelves would be empty. So we have to look at how do we produce enough to do that? How do we produce enough to make sure we're sufficient if there was a disaster? Like we just had a hurricane, and if we were cut off from the mainland, or we were cut off from the rest of the provinces, we would never survive. So there are the issues. Seniors are a big issue. Healthcare is a big issue. The economy is huge, and I'm hearing a lot about agriculture as well. And the green economy is huge as well, the green climate change and stuff. So we do have some plans to fix most of those things. So it's a big thing moving forward, and I encourage anyone to go look at our website and read up on and educate yourselves on what the plan is, and it would make a big difference in how the people would look at the Conservative Party compared to where they're at now.
Do you get any sense that running under the Conservative banner, as opposed to the Progressive Conservative banner, might be a bit of a challenge, and the federal Conservatives might scare some people off in Cape Breton?
Oh, no, I do hear that, Bobby. But the other thing, the big thing I say to people is, who are you going to deal with if you have an issue? Someone comes into my office with an issue, especially, and I've proven it provincially, they don't deal with the leader. They deal with me as the MLA or hopefully as the MP. I take those issues to Ottawa or to the group of people that we could see to help it with, and then it's our responsibility to deal with that in bigger up the ladder, as they say. So you deal with me, I take those issues, and then I deal with the people that are dealing with it in Ottawa. So I like to think that my ability to talk to people, my ability to deal with issues has been proven, and I would like to continue that on a higher scale. But I do hear that from people that they're concerned about what the Conservatives' plan is. But under Conservative governments before, we have reduced the debt. We have reduced the amount of money we pay on the debt, being able to put that back in the programs and services that help all Canadians.
But I wonder if some people are a bit nervous that maybe that focus on the fiscal side of things, the reducing debt and deficits and so on, may come at the expense of social programs that people in this area rely so heavily on.
Well, we've said we wouldn't change the commitments that the Liberal government has there now, but if you take things like the 250 some odd million that they've sent over to the Chinese Infrastructure Bank and put that back into our economy, there's ways that you can save and there's ways that you can add to the economy without cutting programs and services. And we've already said that we wouldn't cut programs and services that are already committed to. So that's something that you can save money and find ways to save money other than cutting programs and services that affect the people in Nova Scotia or the people in Canada directly.
Your predecessor, Mark Eiking, was the MP for nearly 20 years. You know, we've seen both Mr. Eiking and Roger Kostner make lots of announcements as for government funding here as members of the government over the years. What are people saying about having that representation on the government side in terms of being a benefit, in terms of getting more from the government?
Well, first of all, let me thank Mr. Cosmer, Mr. Eiking for their service. Public service is not an easy thing, contrary to what people believe. It's very difficult. Being on the government side surely makes it easier to lobby your own people to bring program services and money to the area. So hopefully that's the case after the next election. We've been known in Cape Breton to always try and seem like we're on the wrong side after we're done, because we have a tendency to vote for the person they think they can do the best job, or the person people feel that they are more approachable. So being on the government side is a big bonus, but not being on the government side, you're still able to get things done as long as you work with people, because politics is a funny game, and you have to be able to work with all stripes and colors to do what's best for the area you're representing. Now, Alfie McLeod and I hopefully will be representing the people of Cape Breton Island. We've been proven before to work together to do what's best for the island, and I'm not beyond working cross-party lines to get what's best for the island and deal with the political side of it later. So, but it does help when you're on the good side of government, because it makes it easier to go to the people that are friendly, I guess is what you want to say. But if we can prove that it's something that's good for the island, good for the people, or good for the province, then I'm sure that whoever it is that's in power will see that as a good thing and help us along the way.
And you are, speaking of your political experience, you are facing opponents who are rookies. What advantage does your political experience give you, do you think, when it comes to the voters making a decision on who the best representative would be?
Well, being there already and seeing a lot of the issues firsthand, dealing with a lot of the issues firsthand is a big plus. I believe the experience you get when you enter politics, it takes about two and a half years to get really proficient in what you're doing and understand the systems and understand the people you're dealing with. So it's huge to have that experience, knowing that you're going to deal with certain bureaucrats or certain ministers or certain departments of government or municipalities or provincial representatives, federal representatives, knowing how to deal with people and having done that, knowing what obstacles you may face before you even start, is huge when it comes to doing what's best for the people you represent.
Despite your experience, it is at the provincial level. You're now running federally. You've got, I believe, a bigger district geographically. What challenges are you finding there in trying to get familiar with the new riding?
Well, the riding is a lot bigger, of course, but being able to talk to people, I've been to a few sessions in areas where I don't represent now provincially, or didn't represent provincially, I'm sorry, and to hear the concerns, say, of the fishermen down north, I've been down talking to them, to hear the concerns of the people who live in New Waterford, I've been out talking to them, to hear the concerns of people who live in Bedeck, we've been talking to them, I've been talking to some of the people that live in Escazoni, member two, just to get around to those areas and have frank conversations with the people who live there, who understand the conditions and the problems in their area, is huge to understanding the whole riding. But knocking on doors and hearing from the people themselves is the easiest way, because you hear all aspects, you hear all problems, you hear different issues from different people. But it's huge. You can't knock on every door in this riding. It's just it's physically not possible. But we do have like open houses or go to events where people are and hear that from them is the biggest thing that you can do. And drawing on the experience that we had before of dealing with people, I like to think I'm a people person. I like to think I'm very approachable, and I like to think that I listen to everyone's concerns without judging anybody before, so that we give them the best representation we possibly can.
So you're putting a lot of kilometers on the car, though.
Oh, God, no, yes. I put just on my own vehicle that I'm driving well over 5,000 kilometers already, and it's just getting started.
The Liberal candidate in the riding is 40-year-old Jaime Batiste, a former senior advisor to Escazoni First Nation and former professor of Aboriginal and Treaty Rights at Cape Breton University. He spoke with Dialogue's Dave DeVoe.
Well, I guess the biggest reason I decided to run is because I felt that I could make a difference. I felt that my type of leadership was the type of leadership that was all about creating unity, that it was all about working together with people. You know, the late Charlie Joe of Chief Charlie Joe Dennis of Escazoni once told me, you get a lot more done by making people feel like they're part of the solution instead of making people feel like they're part of the problem. And I really felt that we needed more collaboration in by way of Cape Breton in getting things done. I feel like the future of this island depends on collaboration between all levels of government, the municipal government, the Mi'kmaq government, the provincial government, and the federal government. And I wasn't seeing that happening enough. And I felt like with my background of negotiating and advocacy and working with all of these levels of government for the past 20 years, that I would be an excellent candidate to help bring unity to this island.
Okay, so you say you haven't been seeing enough collaboration or the kind of collaboration that you would like to see, but yet you're running for a party that has formed government for the last 4 years. So is that a comment on the way they've been conducting themselves?
I think better is always possible. I think that when you, if you can look at things from the federal viewpoint and say, you know, this is all on this party for the past 4 years, but more or less, I think the responsibility is shared by all. I think we need to work together in Cape Breton. A lot of times we seem to be working in our own silos, and I feel that we should be working together. I've been involved in Engage Nova Scotia for the past few years, and one of the things we did with Engage Nova Scotia is bring together the five municipalities and the five Mi'kmaq bands. And before I got into politics, you know, I got up in the front of the room and said, you know, we're creating all of these great vision for Cape Breton. We're trying to work together. But when we get this done, we're going to become pitchmen to the province and the federal government. I wanted to see the province and federal government as part of the grassroots, as part of, you know, the starting point in saying, you know, we can work together to solve these problems. And if we're working together at the bottom level, going all the way to the top, it makes it easier in the future if we're all feeling like we're part of the solution.
So just to put some proverbial meat on the bones here, what specific policy forms would that take? What do you think can be done to foster greater collaboration, say, on economic development between the feds and the province?
Well, we have amazing opportunities in front of us. I mean, in Cape Breton, we have our scenery, we have our seafood, we have the most amazing golf, you know, tourist attraction out there. And our music, you know, we have a very distinct music and cultures in this area. We have so much to showcase to the world. But Cape Breton has often been, you know, the biggest hidden treasure, maybe in Canada. And for me, I feel like we need to market our island better. We need to, you know, really say, here is what we're about, and work together to say, you know, here's what we can do in Sydney. One of the biggest things I saw from that Roger Brooks presentation on the restoration of downtown Sydney is, you know, we're promising people, you know, come out here, take a picture next to the big fiddle. And then when we go downtown Sydney, there's not a lot of live music that's going on. Where can you go listen to fiddle music on a weekend or a weekday? And I think that, you know, if we're going to promise this, you know, the big fiddle, and we're going to bring people to attract this area through that, we need to provide live music. And as being a musician for the past 20 years, I know how talented Cape Bretoners are. And we have an extremely amazing talents that are just waiting out there, and we just need to feature them more. And if we work together, I think we can do more.
Now, surely tourism can't be the only component of economic development. You know, one might argue that it can play at best a supporting role. I mean, we have to have industries here, whether, you know, we can debate about the mix of small and large businesses, but, you know, in terms of attracting investment here, what do you think that can be accomplished by way of your brand of collaboration that hasn't been accomplished thus far?
Well, I think, you know, I was just talking with Senator Danny Christmas just earlier this afternoon, and, you know, Danny's talking about more autonomy for Cape Breton, and I understand where he's coming from that, because we have big challenges facing us.
He's not just talking about more autonomy, he's considering separation. Is that something you'd entertain, or?
I understand the premise of it. I'm not going to go that far yet, but, you know, I've had conversations with Danny Christmas and Rankin McSween about that, and seeing the difference, you know, that having its own autonomy would create. Because if you look at PEI, they're the same size as Cape Breton, yet they have the ability to bring in a lot more immigrants than we are in terms of, you know, have a bigger autonomy. But I think when we look at it and say, you know, as Cape Bretoners, we're going to have more collaboration, I think you're right. It can't be all about tourism. But, you know, we have amazing opportunities, you know, with Novaport, and I've had conversations with the Chief Terry Paul and Leroy and even Cecil Clark about, you know, the amazing, you know, opportunity that we have in Novaport that we haven't been able to move forward on yet. And if we, you know, all these ships that are going down to Halifax and Boston and New York to unload their cargo, you know, they're all sailing by Cape Breton. And we feel that, you know, if we really put, you know, all of our efforts into looking at, you know, possibly developing the Nova Port into what the dream is, that it could, you know, save the economy. It'd be our gateway east. It could be, you know, create 3,000 to 4,000 extra jobs, and, you know, it would go such a way of boosting the economy. And it's going to take, you know, all four levels of those governments working together and pushing this to make that a priority.
What do you say to skeptics that say there's all kinds of factors going against that, like congestion in the Halifax port, a naturally deep harbor in Canso where they have a similar project on the go? And I interviewed a business professor from Dalhousie who said that container capacity is just not going to support it the way it is now. There seem to be, in some people's views anyway, a lot of factors militating against that port project, but you remain optimistic despite those?
Absolutely. I mean, what I'm hearing is that we have private, you know, for every one public dollar that we're looking at, we have $13 private ready to go. And, you know, I think that the people who are running the businesses and people, the private sector, are looking at this because they see an opportunity. And while many, you know, could lobby and say, well, this port or this area needs it or this area is more, since I think the business models that we're looking at in this area seem to show that the opportunity is there and we can deliver things to the Midwest cheaper and faster than anyone else if we were to get this up and going. And truthfully, if you look at it, you know, Halifax doesn't need the jobs that Cape Breton needs. Our economy needs a boost, and we don't have the steel anymore, and we don't have the mines anymore, so we need something.
What do you say to the conservative charge that liberal taxes are too high and that's what's impeding investment in Cape Breton? And you're running for a party that's going to continue to, in their view, tax us too high and continue to impede investment.
You know, it's a difficult slope when you look at taxes. And what I would continue to point to is there's an opportunity there. The private sector is continuing to say you know, private dollars for every one public dollars. And, you know, when we're looking at building this economy, you know, cutting taxes for the wealthy isn't going to trickle down to help Cape Breton. There isn't a lot of wealth in Cape Breton. And so, you know, the conservative idea of, you know, trickle-down economics has never worked.
Well, some might argue that it has. There's economists, for example, who say median income is at an all-time high now. So, I mean, you can talk about inequality, right? But wealth in absolute terms at the median level, so the argument goes, is going up.
I've never seen those economic reports that have said that anything like trickle-down economics work. We, as Liberal government, talk about investing in families, investing in seniors, and investing in the middle class. We're not talking about, you know, tax cuts for the wealthy, because that's never worked anywhere.
I want to switch to environmental matters, because I know the Liberal government ran very much on an environmentalist platform. And, you know, we're living in an area where not only are a lot of people in the oil and gas industry, but that industry is the source of some of the equalization payments on which we depend here. And yet there's some worry about the Trudeau government's environmental approach, specifically worry about the idea of phasing out oil and gas. If you want to develop Cape Breton economically, how are you going to do that when, in some people's view, the Liberal government has been attacking the energy industry on which we depend to a great extent?
If we're going to talk about environment, let's talk about environment. You know, first of all, we have less than 12 years, according to the United Nations, to reduce our carbon footprint in half. The UN called global warming an ear-splitting wake-up call. More than ever before, the future of our planet depends on the next steps that the government takes to address the biggest threat to our existence. And when we're talking about, you know, this, we're talking about the quality of life for our children and our grandchildren. And the biggest thing is we need to make that transition to green energy. And we need to make that transition very soon. Because, you know, we can look at the economy, we can look at all of these things, but every one of us in Canada wants to make sure that our children and our grandchildren have a future. And that's the biggest thing. So when we talk about the environment, let's talk about the environment and what we need to actually see, because, you know, it is possible for us to do something for the environment. And it's going to be over the next 4 years that we can figure out this next government is going to have that task of looking at it and saying, how do we reduce our carbon footprint in half within the next 12 years? And you know what? I don't want to bring, because it can't always be about dollars and cents. We're talking about the future of our children. We're talking about clean air, clean water. And I think that's one of the most important things that we need to focus on. I don't think that the government is having any kind of attack on oil and gas. I think the government is realizing that there's a global crisis and that we need to do our part. And I think our prime minister is one of the leaders who have seen leading the charge on this internationally. Now, I can understand people talk about, you know, there's a pipeline that Canada has built, but what the government has said is that they're taking all of the dollars and all of the profits from this pipeline and putting it towards the transition to green energy. And we have to have that plan. We can't just say that we're going to transition to green energy. It has to be really something that we're taking it and we've figured out a way in which we make that transition based on the current industry. And oil and gas is not going to go anywhere now, but there will come an end to oil and gas in the future. It may not be in my lifetime, but it will come. And so,
but you're confident that
transition.
Yeah, you're confident the transition can be done without too many adverse effects on Cape Breton's economy.
Absolutely, we could. There's so much wind in Cape Breton. We could be making those transitions to the wind energy real quick. But I think it would be a benefit to Cape Breton, not a detriment.
What do you say to some of the criticisms from the other side, like Elizabeth May, who says that Mr. Trudeau's climate targets are actually not ambitious enough?
I know that it's tough being in Canada, where you have two parties to the left and two parties to the right, and trying to have that balance. Governing is a balancing act, and truthfully, in a lot of ways, I share her urgency of saying we need to do more. But I also know that in Canada, there needs to be a balance between, our aspirations for saving the climate and what we can do, ensuring that, to be truthful, that we're not putting too much emphasis on it and then letting the economy go to spoils. I think the biggest thing is that there is always a balance, and you have the NDP and the Green on the left, and you have the Conservatives and the People's Party to the right. And, you know, when you're governing in a central kind of center left location, there's always these concerns of, yes, we want to save the environment, yes, we want to make sure that there's clean air and clean water for our future, but there also has to be considerations of the environment. And that's a challenge with governing. And if I was to say that I had all the answers to that as a rookie candidate who's never been involved in politics, then I'd be misleading you.
You talk about balance, and you alluded before, I think, to the Trans Mountain project. Is that really balance from an environmental perspective? Because some environmentalists will point out that it's increasing our greenhouse gas emissions, and given the scale of the project, will likely do so for a long time. There are unceded territories out BC. The question has come up, is the government just going to impose the pipeline on those peoples in those unceded territories? Lots of environmentalists and indigenous activists say that this is not a balanced approach at all, the way they're going about the Trans Mountain.
One of the big things that the government was part of was, you know, making sure that the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People did move forward and did get put to Senate. And, you know, the government supported that. And even when the Conservative Party and the senators killed that in the Senate, you know, our government said that we'd reintroduce that. So I know that more than any other prime minister in the history of Canada, this prime minister understands what consultation means and is doing his best to ensure that consultation is met, but also that for moving forward with those who want to move forward. In terms of the pipeline, like I said, the transition is going to go to fund the transition to green energy. And so that's the biggest thing that we're looking at in there.
Yeah, it's going to fund transition to green energy, but the criticism is if you build a pipeline that big, you can't just build it and phase it out in 20 years. I mean, we're talking about generations that this thing is going to be running if it's built, right?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Well, if you build something of that scale, it's kind of hard to square that with gradually phasing out fossil fuels, because this thing will be going for generations and keeping emissions going up for generations, will it not?
I think that the balance is there in terms of we need to support the economy, but we also need to make the transition to green energy, and that's what this government is doing, and that's what the government has been left with the transnational pipeline, and that's, I think that I trust that the Prime Minister has spoke with his environmental minister as well as his Minister of Indigenous Services Canada, and they figured out that this was the best approach moving forward.
You're expressing confidence in the Prime Minister. Surely some of that's based on your observations of him, but how well do you know the man personally? Have you spoken to him, and what impression did you get?
Absolutely. I've known, I've shaken hands and spoke to the Prime Minister before he was the Prime Minister. I've, talked to him while he was Prime Minister. He's always made himself available to Assembly of First Nations more than any other government in the history of Canada. He made himself available to First Nation chiefs around the country and made sure that his ministers were available. And I think that the work that they've done and what they've taken the roles of reconciliation, seriously. And I think that more than any government in the history, they've shown not only talk the talk, but walk the walk when it came to reconciliation and came to making sure that Indigenous people were a priority in Canada.
A couple of quick questions before I let you go, Jaime. First on health and social transfers, where do you stand on that? The Liberals have committed to keeping the increase, but the premiers are asking for the rate of increase to go up. What's your position on that?
In terms of healthcare?
In terms of health transfers, yeah.
Well, in terms of healthcare transfers, one of the things that we were told is that we'd be looking at two things. And first, the first thing is having a national pharmacare plan that ensures that no Canadian will have to choose between his medicine and his rent or his medicine and his bills. The other part is the Liberals have committed to a 4.1% increase in healthcare transfers, which is more than any other party has come out with and said. I mean, the Conservatives keep saying they're going to come out with 3% increase, which is basically 1% less than what the Liberals are putting out, which is basically a cut. And we're looking at increasing those transfers and making sure that there's increased support for mental health and seniors in home care. And I think that what we're trying to do is help out Canadians, especially in Nova Scotia.
On the deficits, balancing the need to balance the budget on the one hand and maintain services on the other, another delicate balancing act. How do you view that?
I understand that there has to be balance at some point, and we have to figure out how to ensure that we're not making sure that our children aren't having a future where they're constantly paying down our debt. But I think we have a crucial 4 years right now to do something about the environment, and more than talking about what the deficit and things like that, we need to ensure that our children and grandchildren have a future.
This month is Big Brothers Big Sisters Month, and as usual, the organization is busy raising funds for their programs. We spoke with Cape Breton Area Executive Director Francine Hall.
Being a nonprofit organization, one of the main things we have to do is fundraise. We have to raise 85% of our budget. We have November 3rd coming up is our annual fall auction. That will be at the Steel City Beverage Room in Sydney. And we do our tickets, our big draw tickets. They're a draw a month for a year. They're a $5 ticket. They'll be going on sale shortly. And of course, in January, we start gearing up for our Bowl for Kids campaign, which we do in Glace Bay, Sydney Mines, and Sydney. With all those fundraising events and 15% government funding, we provide programs such as our traditional match or program, which most people are aware of, the Big Brother, Little Brother, Big Sister, Little Sister. We also do cross-gender matching, couples matching, and we have a program that we do in the schools called Go Girls and Game On.
Well, you're busy.
Yeah, a little bit, and I'm the only person in the office.
tell me, how do you sign up? Because this makes a huge difference in the lives of what you call littles, right?
Yes, our littles.
The littles, you're the bigs, and the people that sign up are the bigs, but you told us how it's supported. How much of a difference does this make in their lives?
Well, I can say in 32 years that I've been with the agency, I've seen some wonderful changes. I've seen big brothers, big sisters get married and have little brothers and little sisters stand in their weddings. I have one story of a little brother many years ago. After he graduated, he decided to travel across Canada to find himself. And while he was there, he had signed up for a nursing program and was missing the opportunity if he didn't get back. And his big brother, though we never expect that of big brothers or big sisters, paid for his flight home to get there and to sign up for his nursing. He graduated from nursing, and when he got married, his big brother was his best man at the wedding. So we're hearing stories of this all the time. I received a message from a former big brother who I asked, well, where is your little brother now? And he's married in Boston, and he's a financial advisor. So we see all these success stories and hear of them all the time. They're wonderful. And so we know that not only are we building self-esteem in children, but we're also giving the opportunity of these children to grow into our next generation of citizens in our community as well.
How do you select big brothers, big sisters? And it's a huge commitment on their part as well, right?
1 year. 1 year commitment. And if they want to go over and above that, of course, we will continue the match, as we call it, the match or friendship. There is a screening process where we do an interview and reference checks and police checks, things like that, in order to ensure that this person is a safe person according to our national standards that will be matched with a child in our programs. And then there's, of course, the follow-ups where we have in-person follow-ups, telephone follow-ups every so often to see how they're doing.
You have a waiting list?
Not as much as we used to, and I think it's people kind of forget that we're there, you know, that we do take children. It's not all about just big brothers, big sisters, so that is an important element in it. The other part is, of course, little brothers, little sisters. So if there's anybody that has a child between the ages of 6 to 16, that would like to put their child on the caseload, they can call us, and we will do the interview process for the little brother, little sister, and their parent, and put them on and start looking for a big brother or big sister for them.
Always welcome to any kind of funding that you can get. But sometimes you see people on a casual day in a business or whatever, and they're wearing casual clothes. Could be
that's going on right now for us. Yes, we do that as well. And another new, not a new one, but one that we've been trying to implement, and with the help of different organizations, we're looking at trying to increase the numbers of what we call matchmakers. This here is, it can be geared to individuals, but mainly it's towards businesses, where it costs approximately $1,200 a year to make and maintain a match, so $100 a month. When you look at it, that's not that much money to keep a big brother or big sister and their littles together, because you have to look at all the different costs, maintenance, there is administration costs in that, because there has to be an office, there has to be qualified staff, and we provide activities and the screening process and the follow-ups. So it's not really that bad when you realize how many thousands it costs a day to keep a child incarcerated when they're at a certain age.
So any way you can help, any assistance you want to be of, give us that contact number again, Francine.
So for matchmakers or anything else, 564-5437.
He's one of the biggest country music stars in this country. And the CCMA Fans Choice Award winner has just released a new single called Drink About Me and a new album, Now or Never, that will be out next year. Bill McNeil spoke recently with Brett Kissel.
So you've got a brand new single happening right now that we just added here at the Coast 89.7. And I'm going to tell you something, Brett. You probably know this anyway. There have been so many songs that, you know, that have the word drink in them and so on. And I thought, oh, no, not another party song. You know, one of those, you know, the driving the pickup truck out to the lake with the six pack and the whole bit. And then I went, no, this is Brett Kissel. Wait a second. And when I heard the song, man, it just blew me away. What a great, great tune.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that. That means a lot to me. You know what? I think in country music, I mean, to talk about what you just said, I think a lot of us as songwriters are kind of recycling old material and trying to figure out ways to say the same thing in a different way. And so when you're talking about the tailgates and throwing back a couple of beers or whatever, it's still very much a part of our culture and country music and what we do. But I wanted to take it one step further and kind of put a unique twist on a classic tale about missing somebody so much it hurts and going into the studio and telling this story that, you know, do you ever think about me, but do you ever drink about me? And I'm really proud with how it turned out, and that means a lot that you would say that you love this song, as it's kind of risen to the top and risen to the forefront of the other drinking songs that can get played on country radio.
I want to talk a little bit about the video for this song too. If folks haven't had a chance to check it out, it's a pretty nice video, and the timing kind of struck me because what's happened in the Bahamas, obviously with the hurricane, this was shot obviously months before that or whatever, but that must have hit home for you a little bit too.
You know, it really did. You know, we filmed our video in South Andros Island of the Bahamas, and it truly was paradise. If anybody sees the video, I mean, you can just Google, you know, the Bahamas and look at some of the most beautiful picturesque photos, you know, that the eye could see. Our time there was extraordinary. Our hosts were Brian and Sarah Balmer from the great HGTV show called Island of Brian. They've got a beautiful resort out there, and we loved every minute of it. We were there only weeks before the hurricane hit. Of course, there was no talk of a hurricane or anything like that coming through. Obviously, we left. We make our video. We put it out, and Hurricane Dorian hits, and a lot of people lost their lives. It's very, very sad to have something like that go through an area where we just were. Now, our resort that we were at wasn't affected. That was South Andros Island. It's Grand Bahama and a bunch of other islands that were truly affected by Hurricane Dorian. But I have to compliment and support Brian and Sarah as great philanthropists and entrepreneurs and business people. What they've done is they've done very well for themselves, and they've donated a significant amount of money. They've also started an incredible GoFundMe page from their resort, as well as their own personal pages that I've shared on my social media, to help raise as much money as we can for the Red Cross and a foundation that they put together to help people in the Bahamas who've lost their lives and have lost everything.
And we'll make a link, of course, to that information that you mentioned as well on our homepage and on our social media too here at the Coast.
Thank you for doing that.
Brett, I want to talk a little bit about this album. The new album is going to come out, I think, New Year's Day. Is that right?
That is correct, yes, sir.
Okay, so New Year's Day, the new album. The thing you've been able to do, which constantly amazes me, is that everything you do has a little something different to it. You don't get stuck in one vein or a rut per se. Some artists will do that. They'll tend to, you know, they'll do four or five ballads at a time, and then things start to sound a little bit similar production-wise. But you've been able to do that ebb and flow with your music, and I suspect this is just the tip of the iceberg for the new album, the first single.
Well, very, very much so. Thank you for saying that. Everything that we do has to have some, you know, something different involved. I guess it's a little je ne sais quoi. Sometimes you can't really explain what it is, but we know internally that it has to be different from what you've done, because that's how you improve. And I wanted to make sure that with this new record, that the song Drink About Me has a life of its own. That is the only song on the record that is like that. Everything else on this project that comes out on January 1st, 2020 is completely different from this. So truly, there's great variety and diversity on this record. So with that being said, in country music, people are listening to different styles of country music, from traditional country like Chris Stapleton to great pop country like Dan and Shay to rockin' country like Al Dean to, I don't know, a bunch of different areas of country, acoustic country like maybe Miranda Lambert, The House That Built Me. We all love country music because it's ever-encompassing. So we wanted to make sure that this project of ours has not just a little bit, but a lot of everything. We've got a song like Drink About Me. I've got a very dance, like EDM pop song on this record that is still a country song. I've got a traditional country song called That's Country Music. I've got an acoustic country song called Coffee With Her. I've got your straight ahead party song. You're going to crank it to, I don't know, maybe Cavendish Beach Music Festival called A Few Good Stories to Tell. We've got a bunch of songs that truly check off a bunch of different boxes within the genre of country music.
Well, that sounds interesting. We've got to look forward to hearing that album. And as mentioned, it comes out January 1st, New Year's Day, is the official release date for the new album. You had a big weekend as well with the CCMAs. Congratulations, sir.
Thank you very much. I'll tell you, that was one of the greatest parties and one of the greatest weekends I've ever had.
Yeah, I would have loved to have been there. I think the last time we had a chance to catch up with you was back in Halifax when CCMAs were in Halifax, and that was a great time as well. But I want to say hats off to you, especially for winning the Fans' Choice, because I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Brett, but of all the awards, and I mean, you've certainly had your share of them so far, is that the one that means the most, though, because it's from the fans?
You know what, I have to admit, and I have to say yes. Don't get me wrong. Getting an award that's voted on by your peers and the industry is extremely special. To hear your name called at an award show or to just be nominated is a real, I'll call it like a 10 out of 10 feeling. It fills you up. That type of validation and acknowledgement is extremely special. But you take it one step further, and to get an award that's voted on by your fans, that's really why we do it. We go out there so that we can play for our fans. We get into country music so that we can, you know, play from bars to theaters, theaters to arenas, arenas to stadiums one day and fill it full of fans. So to get an award voted on by the people, that is an incredible feeling. And it truly takes it from that 10 out of 10 to, I'll call it even a 15 out of 10. That's how special it is.
Wow. Well, you continue to, you know, make great inroads in Canadian country music. I don't think Canadian country music has ever been healthier than it is. Do you agree?
100%. I appreciate you saying that because I couldn't agree more. Canadian country music is the strongest I think it's ever been. Don't get me wrong. We've had our stars in the past. We've had the greats like Charlie Major, who just got into the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
And, you know, the era of Paul Brandt and Terry Clark. But in those eras, there was maybe just two or three stars that really rose to the top to challenge our counterparts in the United States. Whereas now in Canada, I mean, you play a James Barker Band song, it sounds incredible. You play a Washboard Union song, a Megan Patrick song, Jess Moskaluk, myself, Tim Hicks, Dean Brody. The list goes on. What we're capable of doing and the records we're making, the songs that we're writing, are often just as good, if not better, than some of our counterparts in the United States.
Well, I agree with you there, because I'll take Canadian country over anything. It's just incredible the amount of, and great songs, Brett. Great songs that are coming out of Canadian country.
And that's why we love you, my friend. That's why everybody in Canada, you know, we have these opportunities to chat, you know, with you and doing our, we'll call it our media blitz when we're, you know, talking about our new single and everything like that. But to hear you say that, someone who's, you know, been in the radio game for, you know, for a chunk of time and has heard so much, if you're saying it in radio, then it's got to be true. So thank you.
Well, thank you for that, Brett. And look, we wish you all the very best with the new single and the new album. And thank you very much for taking the time to have a chat with us here at the Coast.
No, pleasure's all mine. You know how much I loved my time at the Savoy Theater and spending time in Glace Bay. I cannot wait to come back to Cape Breton and perform time and time and time again. As long as you'll keep having me, I will keep coming.
And that's our show for today. As always, thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue three times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue,
check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.